Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. We have a fascinating, far-reaching publication today, certainly relevant to religions of ancient India and also beyond. Today, we will be speaking about a book called Religion and Myth in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Yes, you heard that correctly, Religion and Myth in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I'm speaking with the author of this 2021 McFarland publication, Dr. Michael Nichols, who is professor of religious studies at Martin University. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
The question that I usually begin with is perhaps all the more pressing in your situation, which is how on earth did this start up? How did you get interested in this? Where did this book come from?
A great question. Well, I guess full disclosure at the outset, I am a Marvel fan and have been since I was a kid, but at no point did I intend really to write a book, especially about that topic, especially during my graduate studies and on, although I have engaged with popular culture.
Go ahead. Sorry, I couldn't help but to quip that many a Mahabharata and Ramayana fan growing up did not intend to study it professionally, but here we are. So sure. It's understandable.
Yeah, I suppose that's not an uncommon thing in scholarship. You get drawn in naturally to the things that you have a passion for, I think, inevitably, right? I guess the seed of it started when I was working on my first book, which is a revision of my dissertation about the Buddhist figure of Mara. As taking a break from that endeavor, I went to see one of the Marvel films, the 2012 Avengers film. And during the course of that film, the audience, and this was a rural Indiana theater, was fairly packed, which was unusual in and of itself. But as the characters began to appear on the screen together, since this was the first film that had a crossover, a lot of the different Marvel characters, when, for instance, Iron Man and Captain America are shown on the screen together for the first time, there was applause in the theater. And then later in the film, when all of the, at that point in time, six Avengers were on the screen together, again, there was an outpour of this emotion and applause. And so I maybe have been attending the wrong movie theaters, maybe the wrong movies, but that was an unusual occurrence for me to have that kind of audience reaction. And that started to make me think that perhaps there was something there, something that was landing with people in a way that was very emotional. And there was a connection. There's something deeper potentially was being channeled there. And as I was finishing up that first book, I did end with a chapter about Mara, in particularly North American and British popular culture. And those moments kind of came back to me as I was getting into the popular culture literature. And then as the Marvel series concluded its first several phases in 2019, the same sort of emotional theater reaction made me wonder, is there something deeper here? And so I started to look at the Marvel films from that guise of, is there something kind of deeper, religious and mythic there? And I started to investigate for the book. And that's what, from my perspective, I discovered is that it does resonate on those lines with traditions from around the world. And so I very deliberately decided that I would look at not segments of the Marvel films or a particular Marvel film against one particular religious narrative, although you can do that. And there are places in the book where I do that. But if I wanted to see if it fit into the wider pantheon of world mythologies in general, then I needed a broader comparative scope. So that's why I took the perspective that I did in the book and found that there were different themes throughout the Marvel films that one could set aside themes from other religious traditions. And that's why I kind of dug out the analysis that I did.
Well, the Enterprise that you describe is alarmingly familiar. I'll share something. I'll probably say a little bit more in this podcast than I do in most. But in 2010, I believe in 2010, I finished my master's degree. I did it part-time. I was working. I was a bit of a late bloomer, shall we say, but I finished my master's. And I was working, I was teaching at the University of Toronto's School of Continuing Studies. I was teaching this one course. And while I was doing that, I was had in mind to prepare an original course for the following year. It ended up being a very successful course. At the same time, I had some friends say they were amazed that I hadn't seen Star Wars. I hadn't seen Lord of the Rings. I had a very probably objectively deprived childhood, but very, very formative in many ways. And they said, we'd love your take on this. So here I am, you know, in my early 30s and watching Star Wars for the first time ever. And I was gobsmacked at how much religious symbolism, mythological material was in there. Same with Lord of the Rings. Same with the one world I was familiar with from childhood was the Chronicles of Narnia. I used to love those books in grade school. And so I said, this is really fascinating. Maybe it's me, but it seems that religious mythological archetypes have found a home in these blockbuster sci-fi fantasy films. And so I decided to pitch this as a course. It was called Myth and Meaning. It was a course that I taught every year I was there. I've recently left to teach continuing studies at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. And I set up the course to be like, okay, well, the first half of the course will look at ancient Near Eastern, maybe Indian, maybe biblical mythological narratives. And the second half of the course will look at these universes. We looked at Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, Chronicles of Narnia. At some point, I folded in a bit of Harry Potter. Didn't discover Game of Thrones until much later, but I wish I had discovered it earlier. And in researching for the course that I had already pitched, that I discovered the work of this figure called Joseph Campbell, who after doing 2 degrees, I never heard of. And I thought, okay, maybe I can, this seems like compelling, you know, it's not above reproach, but it seems quite useful. He's stumbled across a theoretical model I can use as shorthand rather than reinvent the wheel to make this argument. And then to my astonishment, I pitched this course without even knowing this. George Lucas used Here with a Thousand Faces to finish a script for New Hope. I'm like, okay, I'm not nuts. There's something here. Mm-hmm. The academics can argue about it, fine. But the myth makers and the movie makers, they know what works, right? And so I couldn't help but share the parallel between my own earlier comparative mythological study and your own journey. More about you now and less about me. What does the book argue? What are you showing? What is the main gist of the book?
It's the main gist of the book might go back to some of the comments that you just alluded to, is that you can find within these films these perennial ideas, and you can categorize this film as myth in a lot of ways. I think that's one primary takeaway. And when I use the term myth, I'm using it a lot. Figures like Alan Dundas and Robert Elwood, just in this broad category of stories of God's heroes or exceptional superpowered beings whose narratives connect with perennial human concerns. And so when you look at it from that vantage, one of the takeaways of the book is that you find that in spades within these Marvel films. And as such, there's a platform there to sit this narrative alongside other world narratives and see what sorts of comparisons arise and what sorts of areas you can interrogate. I think that one of the things that's especially profitable about that is that you can then maybe understand why there are these emotive reactions, why these stories are so popular generation after generation, why they tend to kind of be reiterated and put on with new clothes. And I think your use of Joseph Campbell is very apt there, is that, you know, as you mentioned, his work is not beyond reproach, but there is something there that fascinates people. I think he put his finger on that. And so the categories can be useful when you think about what you see within the Marvel films. And one of the reasons why I focused on the Marvel films as a text was that they went about constructing a cohesive narrative over these 23 films, at least the 23 that I look at. They are, of course, coming out with more and more all the time. But for that span from 2008 to 2019, the directors and producers and the higher ups within the Marvel Studios are very deliberate about making sure there were links in the chain and that there were resonances and that was building to a conclusion. So you have something that you don't necessarily have within other comics properties, is that there's a beginning, middle, and an end to this text, and it was considered one coherent narrative. And so it could be looked at in that way, perhaps like a Mahabharata or Ramayana.
Yeah, it's interesting to me how deeply resonant this book is with, I guess you could say, my previous career, although that was sort of a side gig alongside interpreting Indian myth professionally in my PhD and beyond. And naively, it took me some time to realize that my indulgence in these archetypal narratives in continuing studies and what I was doing at the academy with the Devi Mahatmya or the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, it took me a while to actually put them together in my brain, that these aren't as different as I originally thought. I mean, there's so many directions I could take this in. I do want to, before I forget to mention, I do want to share that it was also impactful to me to see or understand or feel people react when Luke destroys the Death Star. And for me, it's clear, today happens to be May the 4th, I believe, believe it or not.
I was just thinking of that as you were bringing that up.
Entirely unplanned. Michael was kind enough to reschedule. I wasn't feeling so well last week. I think out of about 110 interviews, he might have been the only one or two that we have to reschedule, but apparently the force is with us, so we can do it on May the 4th. But it's so exciting when Luke destroys the Death Star or various other moments, and the audience alights to a feeling of triumph or exhilaration. They're moved. And I don't mean this so literally, but not so symbolically either. It's a religious experience for many of them. And I think it's compelling to understand, it sounds nerdy, but even for those who aren't diehard, practicing Jedi or really into Lord of the Rings, you know, when Gandalf takes a stand and says, "I'm a servant of the secret fire, you shall not pass," it's electric. Mm-hmm. It's more than dramatic flair. It's watching a dramatized archetype before your eyes, and there's such a response in your being that surely there's something going on in sci-fi, fantasy, hero narratives that's beyond just telling a good story, I think. And I really do resonate with the idea that this is the modern world safe, secular repackaging of the world's great religious themes.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And I think within the Marvel films, the corollary for that experience that you're describing is that moment in the Avengers Endgame when Tony Stark has taken the Infinity Stones himself and defeats Thanos' army. And in some media just released by Marvel, it was just yesterday, I believe, that is setting up their coming movies and properties. The beginning of that trailer for those new upcoming properties shows some of the highlights of their past. And that clip of Tony Stark with the Infinity Stones is what sets up the whole thing. And they actually film the opening night audience's reaction. And it's that same kind of electric, ecstatic, transcendent experience of people standing up and cheering as he does this. So there's this catharsis, I think, in all those films that really resonates with a kind of religious catharsis. And I think your comparison to a safe, secular sort of religious expression is very apt indeed, that it's it, really repackages and remodels very, very old ideas.
Well, it's sicking me some time to come at this situation or the stance, I suppose. Not all scholars need to be seekers, but the ones who are successful scholars and successful seekers, or the spiritualists or philosophers in some way, they understand the limitations of both, and they also understand the ways in which the complementarity of each for mapping what it means to be human. And that hair-raising, electrifying, triumphant, terrifying moment, like that experience, what is that experience if not the Vishvarupa, Krishna's terrifying cosmic form on Kurukshetra, or Moses before the burning bush, or Durga slaying Mahisha in the middle of the Devi Mahatmya, you know, a big Drakaris from Daenerys, whatever you want to call it. There are these moments that are just, if you're remotely emotionally or spiritually plugged in, they're larger than life. And they are just beyond. And so I would imagine for many, prior to the age of Marvel Comics and the big screen, those moments were achieved through religious storytelling or mythological narration. Just for those of you listening, I'm sure you know, you've heard enough of these podcasts to know that they're entirely unscripted. It just so happens that this work came across my desk that's completely awakening of a previous career of mine. New, so it's really, really fascinating. More to the point of your scholarship, why don't you take the audience through the structure of the book? And also beyond that, I want to talk about some specific narratives that you draw on.
Absolutely. So the book is structured and set out to follow the development of the Marvel films chronologically. So since they form a coherent narrative, I start with the beginning and go through the middle and the end. With the phase one films, and then follow with the phase two and then phase three from 2000 to 2019. But along the way, the book is structured into different chapters that hit a particular religious theme and mythic theme that seems to help that part of the narrative hold together. So for instance, in the phase one films, there is a great emphasis on the hero's origin stories. And I use a lot of theory about ritual and initiation to talk about what those are like and how those can resonate with those mythic structures. From there, we go into discussions of the hero and the monstrous, the particular villains that the Avengers and so forth face, and how those then parallel different monsters and villainous and evil figures that you find across world religions, world mythologies. The third theme that I delve into is about purity and pollution, which again is a cross-cultural theme. And you find that in the successive films within the Marvel Universe, where once the heroes have been introduced, there are following that certain problems and complications that arise. And these often take the form of what you would, from an anthropological and sociological point of view, look at as pollution and impurity, oftentimes connected to the very powers that the heroes themselves possess. So there's a paradox there about what it means to be connected to the language that I use in some ways. It seems to be a corollary to the powers that the heroes possess is the sacred, or some way being touched by the divine is also problematic within the context of one's connections to others. From there, we move into discussion of the morality of war, when the heroes themselves begin to combat and fight with one another, where the tension that used to be deployed against an external other is then redeployed against an internal other. And there are plenty of narratives across mythology, such as the Iliad, the Mahabharata is a great example of internecine strife, and the to me, at least, was striking how a lot of the conflicts within the Marvel Cinematic Universe, from that point of view, really paralleled and followed the structure of those particular world mythologies. From there, I spend a great deal of time looking at the final two Marvel films within this first three phases, which particularly deal with the struggle with death and trying to deal with the inevitability of human mortality, which is, of course, a perennial religious theme. This within the main villain of the first three phases the Marvel Cinematic Universe as Thanos, the personification of death. I compare Thanos with other symbols of death throughout the world, from ancient Maya, Hades in Greek mythology, Yama in India, Mara, of course, in Buddhism, and then the final struggle with death to try to overcome death's power, which is in itself a paradox, that the heroes can't fully escape. They can overcome death in some ways, but not in others. And so that's kind of the note that the narrative ends on. It's the note that the book ends on. So that's really kind of a quick overview of the way the book is laid out, following the story of these Marvel films from beginning to end, and then punctuating it with these different themes that I think are especially pertinent and relevant to some sections of that narrative.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Since this podcast will probably be hosted on the New Books in Indian Religions podcast that I primarily host, although there's without question, this will be posted to a number of other channels, can you say a bit more about what your research tells us or shows us about narratives of South Asia?
Absolutely, absolutely. Really quickly, there are different points in time when I do bring in the figure of Mara, since my first book was entirely about Mara. It's hard for me to get entirely away from Mara, which I guess is kind of a pun, since that's the role that Mara is supposed to do in Buddhism, is the grasper of being. So I haven't fully escaped from Mara's grasp. He's particularly, I think, a good comparison for some of these figures of death and figures of evil within the Marvel films, because just like Mara, these figures oftentimes have their henchmen who are depicted in a much more grotesque way than they themselves. Just as Mara has his army, which is far more gruesome and ghastly than Mara, he himself is. And they also have this combination of death and desire, just like Mara does. So that's one example. Within Hinduism, one narrative that I come back to in the book again and again is the Mahabharata. First, there's a particular film in the Marvel franchise, Captain America Civil War, where the Avengers, who have been allies to this point, split into two different factions and have what ends up being a disastrous conflict with one another that shows a degradation in their relationship and a conflagration that ends up having long-lasting consequences when they're then not able to reunite against later threats. And so I compare this with the terrible war between the Kauravas and the Pandavas, and the ways in which the practice of that war starts off first with professions of honor and duty and fealty, and then degenerates into almost an anarchy and a renouncing of some of those former rules of combat. You find the same thing within the Marvel films, where it starts off as almost a kind of a jousting and almost a kind of play fighting, then degenerates into a very bloody and terrible conflict. Two figures within another particular film, Black Panther, I thought were corollaries for the particular Arjuna Karna rivalry that you find within the Mahabharata. The figure of T'Challa, who is the Black Panther, and his long-lost cousin, in Jadaka, who is also called Killmonger, seem to fall into figures like Arjuna, who has been part of the social system and has had the benefits of that social system, whereas Karna has been on the outside looking in and resentful as a result. You find almost an identical structure between the two cousins, T'Challa and Enjidaka. Enjidaka, who has been excised from the family line, the forgotten member of the family, who's raised in other circumstances and hasn't been the beneficiary of the royalty that he feels he is owed. And he returns into the palace with a bloodlust for T'Challa, just as Karna wants to exact his revenge upon Arjuna. So that, I think, was an interesting interplay to see a very similar sort of dynamic arise within the Marvel films that immediately, in my mind, reminded me of the South Asian narratives. Those are, I think, two of the big ongoing comparisons. There are also other places, I think, that would interest scholars of South Asia. I'd make discussions about purity and pollution codes and how they play into some of the symbolism you find within the Marvel Universe. I talk about Hindu goddesses and a very brief mention as a corollary with the energy that the Shakti that Hindu goddesses hold and some of the female superpower characters, particularly Captain Marvel, seem to exude. So those are the things I think immediately that spring to mind that would be of interest to scholars of South Asia.
How do you account for the parallels that you see between ancient mythic narratives and these modern fantastic narratives, pun intended, fantastic? Otherwise put, do these modern myth makers, for me, there's no question that Tolkien's a myth maker, that C.S. Lewis is a myth maker. There's no question in my mind that George Lucas quite consciously set out to make a modern mythology. So the myth makers of these movies, did they go and read ancient Indian myth? Like, how do you account for these parallels?
Yeah, that's of course the, I think, the quintessential question. And I don't know that there's a single answer. I think that it's probably a combination of both. A lot of these myth makers are aware of at least some of the preceding mythologies. If you take, you know, Tolkien, for example, was certainly aware of European mythology and patterned some of the events of his stories on earlier stories, like Beowulf is one great example. And you know, George Lucas, being aware of Campbell's work, was trying intentionally to create a new mythology. I think in some cases, some of these stories had to have been ones that the makers of the Marvel films were aware of. But I think that only gets you part of the way, because at least in the study that I did, the resemblances were so vast and go across so many different corners of the world that I think that it speaks to some of the universal issues that all cultures and all individuals eventually face. The most striking probably is that we all have to face up to our mortality. That's something that we're all in the same boat, no matter what time period or culture that you live in. And so that is a dilemma that any mythology or any individual is going to face. And so this is an example, another mythic take on that. You know, the same thing with other issues like how you interact with one's family, the morality of war. Some of these timeless issues, I think, just reoccur and are universal human problems. And so any mythology is going to deal with one or more of these universal human problems. And I think that we shouldn't be surprised if we see mythologies popping up again and again that deal with these issues, because they're just part of what it means to be human.
Yeah, that really resonates. You know, when I, as I mentioned, I did a couple of degrees at the University of Toronto, and I literally never heard of Joseph Campbell. Then I soon learned that he's typically not acceptable as a scholarly source, but I was using him to teach adults who were quite interested in the courses, and many of them were reading his stuff when it was coming out in previous generation. And so as an academic, I would use Campbell potentially with some reservations, but more, I think, clarifications and more delimitations of his work. In terms of when I teach and coach and live and breathe, it's abundantly clear to me that the human condition isn't just society and culture and everything in the outer world. The human condition is very much about, it's about our worldview, and our worldview is very patterned. And our experiences help us to develop this innate pattern that's part of us. And that's when I came across the work of Campbell, and in so doing, really had a good look at Jung for the first time. I'm like, I don't know if what they're saying is true, but I know that this is the best theorization I've come across, or analog, or this is the best way in which to talk about, in terms of scholars, to talk about patterns of human behavior, patterns of the human condition. It's abundantly clear to me anyhow that we are more than just what we experience in the objective world. And there is something that you find a piece of art from ancient Egypt or a different civilization, and certainly it's only going to be enriched if you begin to understand how it was received and why it was crafted in that day. But nevertheless, for the beauty to shine through, it's much more than a product of a specific unique culture or individual. But I feel like I'm preaching to the choir, not that I'm preaching. Anyhow, what was your favorite aspect of this project? Or conversely, what stuck out to you? What were you surprised to learn?
My favorite aspect, I think, was it was certainly an energizing project. I will definitely admit to that. And I've loved all of the other publications that I've done in my first book, certainly, but it was a qualitatively different experience to work on this project, I think, because it did marry together that interest that I'd had since I was very young in these characters and with the professional world that I've lived in since being an adult, in ways that I hadn't anticipated. So being able to think about that realm as a source for my professional world was really, it wasn't something I had anticipated, and it was a lot of fun. It was just a lot of fun to do, to think about them from, you know, from a critical but also a creative way at the same time. And I think that what I learned that I wasn't anticipating is that when I would talk about the project, the enthusiasm that I would receive from people, which kind of demonstrated the reach of it. I enjoy the work that I did on Mara, but when I would mention that, people would kind of say, oh, okay, and kind of smile and nod, and that was the end of it. I would get a lot of follow-up questions and, you know, genuine expressions of interest when I would talk about Marvel and religion and myth. So I think that it's something that had a wider reach, and I wasn't expecting that. So it was the sort of project that I really look forward to working on day after day.
And do you think the reach was simply the popularity of these narratives?
I think so. I think definitely so. And I think that it really, you know, as we've been kind of throughout this conversation coming back to, it's something that speaks to people on a deeper level. And this isn't to say that there aren't other interpretations of particular Marvel films. I don't know of one that looks at the whole span of all 24 or so to this point, but there are particular interpretations of one or the other film, usually from a political angle. They talk about it as a reliving of post 9/11 American trauma, and talking about how the superpower beings, like a revivified United States military, going out and refighting and rewinning 9/11 over and over again. And I think that's an interesting interpretation. I think there's a lot to that, and I enjoyed reading that work. And so what I wanted to do was add to that and supplement to that, what is something that might account for that enduring popularity, for that emotional response at the same time, that would be a global thing, because it's not just a popular in the United States, it's a global cinematic phenomenon. And why it would be popular with individuals who were, frankly, you know, not even born when 9/11 happened. And that's it. It speaks to something more, you know, something deeper, a little bit more universal. It hits some of these tropes, and these archetypes that go way, way into the past.
Yeah, I've come to think of it as two orders of analysis, or that they were at least anyhow, or two orders of reality that are both true in tandem, in that one in my brain is called the sort of sociocultural dimension. And the other one I call, or I think of, as a psycho-spiritual dimension. And certainly it's the case. I mean, the Chronicle, all of Narnia exists in a wardrobe in the countryside of the UK during World War II, right? Ring of Power, hello, we know what this is responding to or energized by on some level, without question. I think I've said this in a lecture earlier in the week. I was saying stories that survive centuries and millennia don't do so because there's a shortage of human ingenuity and creativity in these cultures. How many stories end up on the cutting room floor every day? The ones that survive are the ones that remain relevant. And the Mahabharata, of course, is teaching us about ancient India and about Dharma and about pretty much all things Indic. But no, the Mahabharata is teaching us about us. Mm-hmm. Mahabharata is teaching you about you. Star Wars is teaching you about you. The aspects of you that are not tied specifically to a generation or a culture. And, you know, there's that, it's difficult because I find that it's easy to focus on one and de-emphasize the other much to your own peril, because obviously a narrative is a product of time and culture, obviously, without question. But the classics are obviously more. And if they weren't, no one would care about them for that long. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't know, I imagine that there are, I don't really have a sense to gauge whether, how seriously our colleagues take this line of inquiry or questioning. You know, I'd be interested in your thoughts in terms of, you know, people don't teach Joseph Campbell. As far as I can tell, he's not really taken seriously. And as I've mentioned, I think he needs, I think that he could be bolstered or corrected in certain ways, but I really don't think he could be dismissed or should be. I'd be curious to know about your thoughts of that in terms of the state of scholarship on these sorts of narratives.
Yes, thank you for that question. I think that's one of the things that I was trying to accomplish in the book too, as maybe the introduction and then the conclusion point towards, is to think about how these materials can be put alongside others and put within the pantheon of all the different narratives we do study, we do look at. And, you know, I draw, you know, slightly in, you know, a couple different places on Joseph Campbell. I don't use his work throughout the book by any means, but I think that you're right, that there are definitely ways that you can still draw on a figure like him to think about some of the more universal aspects. And popular culture is popular for a reason. It gets that reaction for a reason. And I think that if we leave out those sorts of narratives from the categories of things we can talk about, then we'll become more and more remote, more and more removed from people's actual everyday experience and the things that people actually find interesting and talk about. So if one of the takeaways from the book is that we can look at the Marvel properties as a mythology, and that gives us a whole other world that we can explore for potentially humans' religious expression, for ways that humans find meaning. And it then enlarges the scope of our field, I think, to encompass more of people's actual experience.
Is there anything else about the book that you hope we touch on?
It is, as we've kind of gotten into, it is a really broadly comparative work. That is something that does swim upstream against the usual tendency of scholarship these days. And so scholars who are interested in broad comparison, I think, find this book interesting. Though it is more interdisciplinary at other points in time, when there is something that I think is a psychological theme, I draw upon psychologists of religion. When there's anthropology, I use figures like Mary Douglas. And so it is something I've tried to draw a lot upon. And some of that goes back to the teaching environment that I came from prior to working at Martin University. I taught at St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer, Indiana, which had an interdisciplinary, before unfortunately the college closed, I had an interdisciplinary general education program that I was thankful to be a part of. And so being able to draw upon all of those different fields and different disciplines to think about a particular narrative or text is something that I learned from teaching in that program, because of the wide-reaching connections we had with colleagues from a lot of other departments. So I'd like to think that that core way of looking at things can kind of live on a little bit in this book. Those would be some of the things that I would mention also about the work and about who might find it interesting. I hope there are a lot of people who would be be able to find something useful and entertaining about the text, if nothing else.
Without question, a number of folks, whether fans of modern narratives, whether people interested in religion and popular culture, I mean, there's certainly is appeal. Commenting on what you just said, I think it's very important personally. I think humanities is about human experience, as obvious as that sounds. That gets lost in the shuffle, and that experience is not amenable to fitting into one paradigm or one discipline or one methodology. And so when people get together who study human beings from these different aspects of the human experience and they have meaningful conversations, you're only going to have a more complete vision or sense of the human experience. And so Mary Douglas, I mean, I'm convinced that she wrote her final book for the sake of my dissertation. Her final book wasn't ethnography at all. She was able to figure out that ancient narratives from the Iliad, from the Bible, were composed in this thing called ring composition, and that that form, that compositional strategy, was crucial for exegesis. It was a hermeneutic strategy on behalf of its authors or redactors. I come across this jewel of hers, and I'm convinced she writes for me before she leaves this earth. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. The same thing applies to the Devi Mahatmya, the great goddess myths of ancient India. Cool. Do I need to answer the question of whether or not, you know, an author of the Iliad that traveled to India at some point and left a tradition of ring composition? I don't know. I have no idea. We'll never know. The point is that ring composition crops up across the ancient world in a very meaningful way for the stories that have stood the test of time. And it's ludicrous to think that's coincidental. And so I just wanted to comment on the power of interdisciplinarity with respect to what I view as a more robust approach to the humanities. Enough for me for one day. Before we say goodbye for today, just tell us, are you still working on this topic? What are you currently working on?
I'm currently working on a couple of different things. I'm working on a couple of articles, one about Buddhism and sickness in the wake of the pandemic, some comparison between Buddhism and Hinduism in terms of the concept of wilderness, forest, and the dangers therein. But I'm keeping my eyes on the Marvel properties that continue to come out, the television shows, as well as the upcoming Phase 4 films, because you never know, there might be something else that's that I could write on about that. I don't think I'm done quite with that yet.
Well, you're keeping your eyes as in your scholarly eyes, but certainly your entertainment eyes are already on them. So that's good.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
As did I. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Michael Nichols, Professor of Religious Studies at Martin University, on his brand new 2021 publication, Religion and Myth in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Until next time, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the role of mythological narratives in the modern world. Take care.